You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Manuel toko ingoa, nau mai, hari mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. I am your host, Emmanuel, and I'll be with you for the next hour. And I'm joined by my hosts, my producers, Theo and Toby. Alright, FY Akane coming up on the show for our weekly catch-up with the Green Party. I spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez-March about the Green Party's proposed national electrification plans. And Monday, Wire producer Thomas spoke to Save Science Coalition spokesperson Ben Wiley van Erd about cuts to the government's science funding. And Toby, what do you have for us today?
I spoke to Otago University research fellow Michael Swanson about the Prime Minister's recent vote of confidence.
And Theo, what do you have for us today?
I spoke to Parents for Climate Aotearoa's Alicia Hall about their campaign to restore rural bus school routes and lower fees for students under 25.
He aha o whakaro, we'd love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku patahi mai, text in on 5395. Ko wā e wareware, e aha ana koutou te whakarongo ki ana korero anō. Hei pakeheri rukiruki mā runga I te pai, tukutuku I irirangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March.
Last week, the Green Party leaders of Marma Davidson and Chloe Swarwick hosted their State of the Planet address where they launched their call to electrify the nation. On top of that, events this week have led to the party to criticise the government, the first instigated by the floods that swept the nation, hitting the Coromandel and causing a state of emergency in the Wellington region. They criticise the government's decreased funding of flood responses as harsh weather increases. And second, a cabinet paper this week has shown the government is planning on moving ahead with reforms to legislation that will see references of the treaty and Te Tiriti redefined, including weakening of the obligations. And what the Green Party says is about, or what the government, pardon me, says is about standardisation, but what the Green Party says is dishonouring the treaty and Te Tiriti. So for our weekly catch-up with the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March, we discuss their criticisms of the government, but start with a discussion of their electrification policy. Kia ora, Ricardo.
Kia ora, thank you for having me.
I want to start our interview this morning by talking about some of the Greens' proposals in their State of the Planet speech, and specifically the electrification proposal to electrify the nation, and I would like you to maybe expound on that for us. What does it mean to be electrifying the nation?
So the war between Israel, the US, Iran, and the genocide in Gaza, the human catastrophe across the region, has also exposed how vulnerable our economy is to warmongering leaders who, through their actions, also disrupt our ability to have a reliant source of fossil fuels that we've for too long relied on. So what we've proposed in this plan is to put in place resources so that homeowners, renters, marais, our schools or farms are able to have rooftop solar and batteries. And this will be through affordable loans, basically. And our plan also includes additional expansion for public transport network to be electrified. These are all things that will create a more resilient economy, but more importantly, will lower bills for people throughout our country, which we think is an urgent thing that the government should be picking up and running with during this fossil fuel crisis.
So within that, these would be structured as loans in particular, especially for the solar or for renewable household energy?
That's right. So basically, this is what has been called the ratepayers assistance scheme. And we know that groups like Rewiring Aotearoa have backed it. And it's a yes and, right? It's also about, as we've said long time since last election, about for example, Kāinga Ora working to also be able to install rooftop solars on state housing as well, right? So it's, you know, throughout public buildings, supporting homeowners, but also electrifying a public transport system, which again, all these things down the line are not just about making our economy more resilient and less prone to shocks when it comes to the supply of fossil fuels, but it is about lowering bills. Electrifying our country will make people's electricity bills cheaper and less susceptible to hikes as a result of disruptions in the economy.
I suppose it might not be completely fleshed out. Actually, that's a good question. How fleshed out are these proposals for the Green Party? Is it clear what is included in this policy? Are batteries included, for instance?
Yes, there would be. And this is taking a lot from our 2023 election manifesto and campaign plans as well, but it's simply adapting it to the situation of today. So in last election, we did provide a fully costed plan around better support for electrifying our economy. And this just simply is an evolution of that that takes into account the current war as well as the fossil fuel crisis. More importantly, though, what we need right now is a government that not just adopts this plan, but stops their reliance on fossil fuels, because that is simply irresponsible and will lead to higher bills and more disruption for people the longer that we take to electrify our economy.
With the loans, is the nature of them that they would be low interest? Would there be interest? How would that work?
Yeah, so the idea is that a lot of these would be low interest or interest-free, but also, again, like it's not just about homeowners. This is also about electrifying our public buildings, such as schools and support for marae, but also, for example, we've long called for more rooftop solars to be built as part of Kāinga Ora housing build programs. And so it's the loans is a component that will particularly help homeowners, but what we're calling for is a national electrification plan that takes into account the need to install rooftop solar and batteries across different types of our buildings, including homes that homeowners may be living in right now.
This is a bit of a separate question, but it's one that I've been interested in a while about solar. There is this distinction within the New Zealand system where you can sell your energy that you create back into the New Zealand grid, and people can't make as much money doing that as they would be buying from the grid for a variety of reasons. When Australia implemented their solar policy, they did effectively like a subsidy for people who are selling back into the system, from my understanding. Or at least they made that a worthwhile thing for consumers to do. Is that something that has ever been considered?
We absolutely are open to that, and all of the national electrification plan needs to be put into and through an equity lens, so that homeowners, particularly people in owner-occupied homes, can actually get the best deal out of this electrification plan. So absolutely something that we're open to exploring as well.
Do you worry if we really, really aced our electricity system that it would invite sort of AI developers into the network?
Well, I mean, I think as long as we have a good framework around AI within the public sector, I am not concerned. The problem with the technologies that we've seen with AI has been particularly the corporates that, you know, like Palantir and others that have shown us that they are effectively operating not for the common good. But I think through good, robust AI policies, I do think governments can actually accept that this is technology that exists, that is being used, but you know, not for the purpose of corporate greed or selling our information out.
I want to move on soon. Is there anything you'd like to finish up on this?
This is a call for the government to get real about the fossil fuel crisis and to stop their plans around you know, the importing of LNG, to simply building more roads and put their energy on electrifying a public transport system, to build more rail and affordable, frequent and reliant bus networks, and to ensure that people are supported through this crisis. Our poorest are being left behind. It doesn't have to be this way. And this is what we're calling on the government to adopt our proposals around the National Electrification Plan, and something we'll be fighting on this election.
Okay. There has been two big criticisms that the Green Party's had for the government this week that I've seen. One being around flood protections. I'd love for you to explain this for us.
Yeah, the previous government allocated $340 million over 3 years for things like flood resilience, including for the one-off disaster recovery funding. This has been decreased by $140 million. We've already seen this year that we've had more extreme flooding events than we've had in quite some time, and it's not even May. And what we're calling for is for the government to restore the funding so that our communities across the country can have the means to ensure that they're better protected against extreme flooding events. Aucklanders know what it is like to experience those, and the rest of the country has been experiencing those recently over, with more frequency. Livelihoods are at risk, our communities are at risk. The government should be putting their resources to ensure that people can have flood resilient communities so that their homes and their livelihoods and communities aren't lost.
And in the context of the floods, especially in the Wellington region, it seems an important time to get this right.
The funding ultimately, it should be about supporting local communities to do what they need with knowledge that they have to better protect themselves against flooding. I mean, we've seen in the Wellington region how unprepared and how outdated infrastructure has led to the flooding having a greater impact. It was the same thing in Auckland, where we've decided to build communities in areas that are prone to flooding, and we either have to accept that some of these homes need to be relocated, but more importantly, that we need to create sponge cities so that we can have the means to absorb that water when flooding comes. And part of that funding is to better protect people against future weather events. And I think this needs to be something that the government picks up adequately resources as opposed to decrease its funding by $140 million.
All right. And on to our second piece of criticism that the Green Party has had for the government this past week has been around the reform of treaty mentions and legislations. Could you explain this to us a little bit?
I mean, it's exactly as you say. The government just simply wants to erase the treaty and its obligations from our legislation. It's irresponsible. It tramples on our foundational document. And I think, I want to remind people that these treaty protections and legislation aren't just a nice to have. They are the foundation of our country. They take into account that Māori never ceded sovereignty. They take into account that we have to work in partnership. And also, tiriti provisions and legislation can also be good to protect us against corporate greed, because ultimately, tiriti is about building a nation that looks after everyone. So extremely concerned. And also, I think it's particularly problematic that the government continues to conflate the tiriti of Waitangi with the Treaty of Waitangi. And these are two completely separate documents as well.
Have we seen the legislation for this yet? Do we know the other pieces of legislation that this one will be impacting?
Well, we've seen a cabinet paper that seeks to amend basically the treaty provisions across 23 pieces of legislation. And so we know that they're preparing for it. And then basically what we know will happen with this, what they're working with, is that the treaty obligations would be reduced to basically just something to take into account. Which means that governments can just basically go, yep, we've taken into account and we don't care. Whereas we need to recognize that we have an obligation to tiriti. It's not just something to take into account when we're creating laws.
Okay, we're coming to the end of our time here. Well, one last thing I'd be interested to know, obviously this is stemming from the National Party's agreement with New Zealand First and their coalition. One of the things that they're campaigning on, or New Zealand First is campaigning on this election, is the breakup of both the gin tailors and the supermarket monopoly. This seems in line with the Green Party's, the specific part seems in line with the Green Party's policies. How do you feel about that when they're proposing policies like this?
The key thing here is that you can't trust New Zealand First to not put corporate greed over the public interest. And this is why, if you want a government that is actually committing to taking on the gin tailors and supermarkets, you have to vote for the only political party that has been consistent on tackling corporate greed, and that has been the Green Party. New Zealand First has been in government and has supported handing out money to the tobacco industry, basically to big landlords, and this is something that shows their true colours. So while we, of course, want similar things in theory, I think the practice has shown us that New Zealand First cannot be trusted when it comes to tackling corporate greed.
All right. Well, thank you very, very much, Ricardo. Have a great morning.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Ka kite.
Ka kite.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March on their party's electrification plans, flood funding, and the weakening of treaty obligations in legislation.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
This is Crow's Eye by Tamaki Mikoto's own Community Treatment Order. We'll be right back after this break.
Wow, we get along so well. I feel like I've known you my whole life.
I know, it's crazy. I'd love to see you again.
Sorry, I just have to ask. Your hoodie is so random. What is 95BFM?
Oh, I knew this was too good to be true.
What? Wait, where are you going?
No!
Show the world exactly who you are with our range of classic 95BFM merch. From the BSA slogan t-shirt to ringer tees and hoodies, get yours now at twotonesmerch.co.nz.
Run! Everyone run! The beast is coming!
It's going pretty slow.
For a monster with such long legs, it takes really little steps.
Should we just walk away?
Yeah, sounds good.
Change is a slow-moving beast. The magnificent new album from Fables is out now, and we have copies for B-card holders to win. Just tune in to 95BFM Breakfast to enter. Change is a slow-moving beast by Fables. Out now wherever good music is found.
I believe in, like, the solar system. I believe in space. I really do believe in space.
Spaced Out. Josh Aoraki from Auckland Stardome Observatory and Planetarium talks everything spacey on Spaced Out. 4:40 every other Tuesday.
Arcade Radio. Thursday night, 7 to 9 p.m. Classic bands, scalding hot takes, and advice on how to cuff your pants. It could only be Auckland's leading skate brand-affiliated radio show.
Arcade Radio. For all that and music from all corners of the globe, tune in to Arcade Radio Thursday nights from 7 till 9 p.m. with Dylan Biscuit and Leon Aoki. Arcade Radio. Only on 95BFM.
Before the break, that was Crow's Eye by Community Treatment Order. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM.
Recently, amid a swirl of media speculation and rumours, the Prime Minister made the unprecedented move of initiating a vote of confidence in himself, with the aim of clearing the air and dispelling the notion that he had lost the support of his caucus. Yesterday, the Prime Minister announced that he had succeeded in the anonymous ballot, although he refrained from revealing the exact numbers. We've seen a variety of reactions from other political leaders, with Labour leader Chris Hipkins insisting that the votes should be released, and New Zealand First leader Winston Peters describing the whole thing as a strategic error on the Prime Minister's part. This morning, I spoke to Michael Swanson, a research fellow at the University of Otago, about the political implications of this vote. We also got into a conversation about the rising popularity of New Zealand First and talked about the future of that party beyond the leadership of Winston Peters. Now, it's certainly not unprecedented in New Zealand politics to see a change in leadership in the lead-up to an election. Jacinda Ardern, lest we forget, became Labour leader just 7 weeks ahead of the 2017 election, which ultimately led to Labour coming to power. But historically, when the incumbent Prime Minister is replaced ahead of an election, it usually doesn't bode too well, Chris Hipkins and Bill English being relevant examples from the last decade. So do you think the Prime Minister's decision to initiate a vote of confidence in himself was potentially a risky move for National during an election year?
Yeah, look, I tend to agree with Winston Peters on this. I think any time you call for a vote on your own leadership, it's not exactly a sort of inspirational move. What people really want to see is kind of someone who's in control, someone who has a real grip on things and can be really clear and direct, both with their own party and looking out. And I think this only raises more questions in that space. So it's probably a very risky move, let's put it that way.
After announcing the results, the Prime Minister refused to take questions and said that he would refuse to engage in any more speculation and rumour. He says that he now considers the matter closed. Do you think that a successful vote in the party caucus will put to rest the concerns about Luxon's leadership among the public, or is confidence in the Prime Minister still shaky?
I think, for the most part, the public actually just want to know who's Prime Minister and get on with it. You know, there's a lot of people out there who are probably sitting there going, this is very much Wellington issues, squabbling within a party. What they really want to know is, what are you going to do for them? How are you going to make their lives better? And all of this kind of infighting just detracts from a lot of what voters really want people to focus on. So the Prime Minister is right when he says, you know, we should be focusing on what matters to New Zealanders. But at the same time, there is a flip side to it where people just want stability and they want to know that you're in control and they want to know that you know what you are doing. So there's a bit of a tension there. I think for the most part, though, your average voter is not overly interested in this. They're kind of in that mode of, come back to me when you've figured out what you're doing so I can make a decision about who I'm going to vote for in November. what it does do is raise that question of, well, actually, what is National doing? What are they up to? What do they stand for? How are they communicating with us? So there are some bigger issues there around some fragility around National that will have voters sort of questioning, are they the party that I want to give my vote to if they can't even organise themselves? They may very well be able to organise themselves and get back to some kind of normality, but it does have these lingering questions in the background.
So it sounds like you largely agree with the Prime Minister, who described the whole situation as a media soap opera, basically implying that the situation has been blown out of proportion by journalists looking for a good story. The Prime Minister also seemed to imply that the internal power struggles of the National Party are not particularly interesting to the general public. So do you agree with the Prime Minister that this issue is mostly a media concoction? And do you think that the way journalists sometimes report on these issues using words like coup potentially catastrophizes what is ultimately quite a mundane political process?
Look, I have characterised these sorts of things as that press gallery bubble that they operate in. So sometimes the press gallery and those in that sort of really, you know, sort of Beltway, Wellington bubble kind of space get so fixated on something like this that they forget about some of the other issues that are going on. So, you know, I talked to a few people yesterday. I'm in Dunedin, and I talked to a few people down here, and they sort of went, what's happening? I'm not quite sure. So they weren't even really that interested. They sort of said, come back to me when there's actually something to talk about. So there's almost a fixation by press gallery reporters on these sorts of things rather than the core issues that matter. And there are some big things happening at the moment that matter to a lot of people that just aren't getting the airtime they need to.
Okay, so on Winston Peters' comments, he described the vote as a very bad move on the Prime Minister's part, ominously warning Luxon that the next time he faces a vote on his leadership, it will not be initiated by him. Peters said recently that in the present era of politics, displaying stable, consistent leadership is absolutely crucial to winning elections. And it's worth noting that since the New Zealand First Party was founded back in 1993, National has cycled through 10 different leaders. Meanwhile, New Zealand First has had exactly one, namely Winston Peters. Could his remarkable political longevity be one of the factors explaining this polling trend we've seen recently of a steady drop in support for National in favour of New Zealand First?
I think there's probably two factors in that. The first is that, you know, Winston Peters set up New Zealand First sort of in the shadow of himself rather than the other way around. National has been this long-standing brand in New Zealand politics going back to the mid-1930s. So they've created sort of party and then had leaders, whereas New Zealand First almost did it the other way around. They had a leader and then created a party. So it's a slightly different way of looking at things. So he has a lot more control and a lot more onus over what happens. Whereas for National, it's more about the party structure and how that works. So it's a far more complex kind of beast. When it comes to the sort of transition between what we're seeing in the polls, I think you can sort of see there's a broader issue in global politics at the moment with centre-right parties struggling to maintain a grip on things and losing out to more populist right parties. And part of that is because people are looking for something different. They're looking for something, that hasn't really had the limelight before. So you just have to look at Australia with the Liberals fading and One Nation coming into the spotlight. And the same in the UK with the Conservatives having a bit of a fade out and the Reform Party coming in. And you're seeing a very similar sort of pattern here, although what you've already acknowledged is that Winston Peters has been doing this a very long time. It's a very long game he has played. And to be honest, this is the best chance he has at becoming that strong forefront of the centre-right. I don't know if he'll get a better chance. He certainly hasn't had one before this.
So you seem to be saying that the appeal of New Zealand First as a party is really dependent on Peters himself as a singular person. Is that right?
To a degree, yes, yes. Of course, he's sort of built a number of others around him. You've just got to look at Shane Jones, and of course, in the last week, recruiting former All Black captain Tane Randall. So he's been smart about who he's brought in around him, but at the same time, he has ensured that it is him who is at the centre. A lot of the decision-making processes in New Zealand First have the leader as the final sign-off, whereas that is not necessarily the way it works in a lot of the other parties. It's far more based on either their party members, their party president, their council, their board, whatever you want to call it. Whereas New Zealand First have managed to have it established around the sort of the personality of Winston Peters. And for a lot of people, that is the draw card. He is seen as this kind of common sense, no rubbish kind of leader who talks about the way it is and the way it should be. And at the moment, that seems to be resonating. That kind of direct approach to what people are thinking and feeling seems to be resonating with an increasing chunk of the population.
Do you think there's a certain parallel there with President Trump? He's also described as a right-wing populist and, you know, seems to be in charge of a version of the Republican Party that's really built around his personality. But a lot of people now wonder what's going to happen to the Republican Party in America with Trump gone. How are they going to find a replacement when so much of the momentum behind the party seems to be built around this one figure?
Yeah, to a degree, although, of course, Winston Peters has been at this for a lot longer than Donald Trump. In fact, you could almost say it's the other way around, that Donald Trump is more of a Winston Peters kind of style personality figure. Of course, they are quite different personalities. I think that needs to be sort of spelt out. They are quite different personalities in the way that they approach things, but they share that similarity in the sort of the cult of personality and the direct approach to politics that they take. In terms of kind of the future of the Republicans, if, you know, with or without Trump, it's a very similar question for New Zealand First. What is the future of New Zealand First without Winston Peters? He is not getting any younger. You know, he is 80-odd, and that is, you know, very much twilight of any political career. So the question for New Zealand First is what comes next? Is it Shane Jones? And would he have the same kind of cult of personality? Would he have the same kind of ability to control the narrative? I'm not sure he does. I'm not sure he has quite the strength of following that Winston Peters does. So there's a real question mark there for Winston Peters and for New Zealand First about, well, if they don't succeed in becoming sort of the forefront centre-right party now, what does the future look like? And I'm not so sure it's as rosy as some might imagine.
And that was Michael Swanson, Research Fellow at the University of Otago.
The government has indicated a
The Wire.
It's time to get action with Action Station Aotearoa, the segment where we chat with the people campaigning for a fairer future.
Despite a tenuous ceasefire, the fuel crisis resulting from the US and Israel bombing of Iran and subsequent closure of the Strait of Hormuz drags on. Prices have remained high, hitting low-income households hard, and while fuel stocks in or on the way to the country sit comfortably above a month's cover, approaches to conserving fuel remain front of mind for many. One strategy that New Zealanders have been urged to adopt is switching to public transport, which would put fewer cars on the road. However, access is often dependent on location and affordability. Over the past few years, the Ministry of Education has reviewed numerous rural school bus routes, cancelling some and cutting off students from ready access to their education. For this week's Get Action, I spoke to Alicia Hall from Parents for Climate Aotearoa on their petition to restore rural school bus routes and make public transport free for children and students under 25. So, kia ora, Alicia. Starting off, can you just give us a broad overview of what your campaign is calling for?
Yeah, kia ora. Thank you for having me.
We've launched an open letter calling on the New Zealand government to make public transport free for all school-age children and half price or free for all young people under 25 and tertiary education. And also to restore cancelled rural bus routes.
And you've connected a lot of these calls to what the government itself is calling for or how they're structuring their approach to the current kind of ongoing fuel crisis, right?
Absolutely. You know, they talk about, I think the Prime Minister himself last month said, you know, and I quote, "I just want to be clear, kids are going to school, they're not sitting at home." And they also talk about targeted and timely a response, and we believe that having children being able to access education through free bus transport, free public transport, is one of those ways to go.
Yeah, so there's two kind of overlapping parts to this, from what I can see. So the first is the affordability of public transport and providing those free or half-price fares. And the second is the rural school bus routes, both of which, of course, have been impacted by this ongoing fuel crisis. So putting the fares to the side for now, do we know why so many rural school bus routes have been cancelled in the last couple of years? Is this purely a cost-cutting exercise, or is there some other reason? What kind of justification has been provided for this?
Absolutely. One of the things that they've done in their review is raise the eligibility, so on along a bus route or in certain areas, from 4 to 8 children. So that's, you know, doubled the eligibility, which means up to 7 families need to now find a way of getting their children to school, plus work. And, yeah, for those that have lost the bus services, they're cutting extracurricular activities like sports because that requires parents to take them as there's no team bus. They're buying fewer groceries. They're putting off GP visits, dentist, specialist appointments. You know, it becomes more difficult to retain staff because having access to schools can be a deal breaker, and workers don't want to spend a large chunk of their wages driving their kids to school when they previously had a school bus.
And it sounds like these school bus routes are pretty essential. Are there any alternatives to getting these kids to school, like thinking like biking or walking or anything?
Oh, it's not, definitely not safe to walk along country roads, as you can imagine. So there are some alternatives that some schools have employed, like getting a pay-as-you-go bus service in. But even those are starting to be cancelled. Like, I noticed an article the other day, a Manawatu school bus is withdrawing its services because it's too costly to run.
Yeah, so looking at these school bus routes and the threshold that you mentioned has been brought from 4 up to 8. Now, you're calling for it to be brought back down to 4. What's the kind of history of these here? Has it been usually for the last while at that kind of 4 threshold?
Yeah, I'm not 100% on the history of that. I just do know that when this new government came in, it set up a review of fleet. I guess to be blunt, you know, all the ministries were required to cut costs, and in my humble opinion, this was one of the areas that they could look at and cut some costs. Like, up to 66 school bus routes have been cancelled, and I'm not so sure, but many have been also shortened, including our own. I'm semi-rural. And, yeah, our local school bus has been shortened down some of the roads so they don't go and collect all the children.
Right, and this becomes a bit of an equity issue, doesn't it, between rural communities and urban communities, in that rural communities are having their access to education for their kids weakened, essentially.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it has a lot of impacts, and they've obviously got to go further to access education and health and things like groceries that we sort of take a little bit more for granted. And there's also, you know, bringing, I guess, tying that back to the urban areas, is that the cost of transporting our kids to school has risen considerably, and the cost of living, full stop. Like, we've got a parent that has been really struggling financially lately and has had to decide whether they put money on their kids' bus card or food on the table or petrol in the car or take them to the doctor. Yeah, there's just all kinds of choices that families are having to make in order to access the basics, really.
Yeah, and kind of pivoting from there now to the bus fares. So you've called for free fares for kids and secondary students. Now, something kind of I'm a bit curious about coming from my kind of ignorance of it, would this include free school buses? I always took public transport to school myself, so I'm not actually sure how kind of school buses work, really. Is it like a subscription kind of payment by students, or is it something that's provided by the school to students for free?
As far as I know, it paid my two high schoolers jump on the public bus and use their Snapper cards to get to school. And we, yeah, pay that just like we would if I was commuting to work kind of thing. I know there's dedicated buses for schools, but it's still pay as you go.
Right, so looking at that, I guess, overall, and again, it's an access issue, right, of getting kids to school, regardless of, you know, the cost issues that they're facing with this ongoing fuel crisis. Jumping on to tertiary students, now I can see that you're calling for free fares for students under 25. Why this particular age? And is that kind of linked to, again, just bringing it back to what the previous policy was before these cost-cutting kind of measures?
Yeah, absolutely. We are a coalition partner of the Free Fares organisation that has been calling this for the last 4 years, I think. And, yeah, that number was determined sort of as the average age of students. I mean, me, myself, up till last year, was a mature student. So, obviously, it would have had benefits to older students as well. But I guess it's a nice round number to go, hey, under 25, a lot at that age going to university. And they can be coming from long distances as well, just to get to their place of education.
Right, and I think whenever kind of people hear that sort of policy for, you know, reduced fees or free fees, they'll probably be thinking about what the cost is going to be overall of that policy. Do we have any idea of the numbers of how much that implementing this would cost overall?
So in 2023, $327 million had been budgeted across 4 years, and the government scrapped the scheme after 1 year when a new government came in. And it's also interesting to note when if we're talking about and comparing costs, well, the 140,000 families that are going to receive are receiving targeted support, that $50 a week and through in-work tax credits. That support will cost the government $364 million for 1 year.
Right, so this is possibly a quite cost-efficient way of meeting this fuel crisis. But jumping to, I guess, the broader picture, now this is obviously a reaction, or the impetus for this is a reaction to the fuel crisis. But given the climate crisis, would you be looking for these changes to become permanent?
Absolutely. We've got other places around the world that are doing this or making public transport incredibly cheap, like I think Queensland's one in Australia. Victoria and Tasmania have temporarily made public transport free. Pakistan has. So it's not a new concept. And, I mean, it honestly just makes complete common sense to be able to provide public transport service, to be able to get people to work, to school, to wherever they need to go. It would be much more productive. It would be much better for the economy because it would free us up to be able to at least put food on the table.
That was Alicia Hall from Parents for Climate Aotearoa on their petition to restore rural school bus routes and make public transport free for children and students under 25. If you'd like to sign their petition, you can find it on the Action Station website or in the description of the BCast for this interview.
That was Get Action with Action Station Aotearoa.
Last week, the Save Science Coalition released a report looking at the impact of government cuts to science over the last 2 years, finding they have led to over 700 roles being slashed. The report contained 11 stories of New Zealand scientists who had to move countries or shift into a different field to find work as a result of government cuts, and made suggestions for non-partisan long-term funding to ensure the security of New Zealand's research and development. To discuss the impacts of cost-cutting to public publicly funded science and potential solutions to the problem. Monday Wire producer Thomas talked to Save Science Coalition spokesperson Ben Wiley-Venerd.
Can you tell us a bit about this report from the Save Science Coalition and give some history on recent cuts to public science research?
Yes, I'd be very happy to do that. The Save Science Coalition is it's a group of a bunch of the different professional societies, physics, chemistry, biology, various things like that, as well as some unions and other people, other organisations which have an interest in the science system in New Zealand. And it was formed 2 years ago because about two years ago, we started to see some pretty substantial cuts being made to the public science funding in this country, faster and deeper than they have been made at any time in living memory. We've been keeping a tally of how many jobs we've seen lost because of these cuts, and we're up to about 700, more than 700 jobs now have been lost out of that publicly funded science sector. We've also seen funding of, we think, about $80 million a year cut. That's over the next 4 years. Obviously, budgets only go out a certain length of time. So a substantial amount of money and quite a lot of jobs have also been lost. We put out a report a couple of years ago on our initial findings about that. And this report is, now that there's been a little bit of space and a little bit of time between that, we can see what the impact has been on some of our science workers. So those who have lost their jobs, where have they ended up? What have they been faced with? What is the research that they were doing? What's no longer being done? And yeah, where are they now, essentially? So we're trying to let everybody know there have been these substantial cuts to science that have had a huge impact in terms of the number of scientists working in this country in the publicly funded sector. And we're calling on political parties to value the public science sector a lot more and to restore us to at least that level of funding that we had before, but ideally move us closer to our OECD peers, because we're historically have been behind for a very long time.
And the report goes into detail of some of the stories of the scientists who have been forced to move out of the country or change field. And some of them are part of some like really crucial projects, like, you know, measuring for natural disasters, for example. How concerned should we be that crucial tech and research is getting cut and weakened in New Zealand?
We should be very concerned about that. There's an element of greater risk that we're now facing. So some of the jobs that we profiled, as you mentioned, were in the Geohazards Monitoring Centre. So we're going to be facing a greater risk from seismic activities, not because there's going to be more seismic activity, but because we will know less about it and be able to respond less capably to it. There's also been a reduction in the animal health and even in the human-like disease monitoring parts. So a lot of these public good functions are the first in the firing line. And what that basically means is that more individuals, more families are going to bear the brunt of those greater risks that the government has decided to take in these areas. More people are going to lose, you know, time and money due to ill health. More farmers are going to lose animals and potentially crops as well due to the same. So that's the sort of the public good for the public side of things. The other thing that's really important is that it's just a very important part of growing your economy in the long term is putting enough money into research and development. We used to be about at the top of the OECD tables in terms of our GDP per capita, but we've slid something like 19 places from our peak in the 1950s. And almost every single country which has become a wealthier country than we has done it by investing more than we do in R&D. There's only a couple of them that don't, and one of those is a very big oil exporter, which obviously is not a realistic option for New Zealand to take, and one of them is an international tax haven. So there are very few ways to become and stay a prosperous country in the 21st century, and almost all of them involve doing research, which means that you can do something better than anyone else in the world, and you can compete, and we're losing that.
Minister of Science, Innovation and Technology Penny Simmons has pointed to growth in the private sector to claim that New Zealand science research is still going strong and justified cuts by saying we're in a tight fiscal period. What do you think about this defence and these comments on such big slashes to public science funding?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that she is right that the New Zealand private research sector has been growing, and that's something that we definitely all should celebrate. But her comments just don't make sense in terms of a strategy for this country. One of the inputs to a well-functioning private research and development sector is a thriving public R&D sector. This is not controversial. If you look at the OEC data, there is no country in the OECD that has reached that 2% total spend on R&D, which includes the government side and the private sector side. No country has reached that target without spending at least somewhere between 10 to 20% more on the publicly funded research side than we have been. That's than we have been before these cuts were done, by the way. So there's a gap to come. The private sector research and the public sector research, they grow together and they thrive together, and they're doing slightly different things. Publicly funded science generally tends to focus on questions of curiosity. It's not so much directed, but it's where those big discoveries are made that can then generate new industries, new businesses, new firms that can use those discoveries to generate income, also to generate other public goods such as good health and lowered risk. So you can't grow the private sector beyond the private R&D sector beyond a certain size without having the publicly funded support there. It's just not borne out in the R&D data.
And can you talk about some of the suggestions this report has to get our public science sector back on track?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the top line suggestion is just to put more money in so that we treat it as a matter of urgency to try and reach the level of R&D funding that our peers in the OECD are trying to do. This has actually been a target that people have talked about in New Zealand for a very, very long time, and it's certainly unclear to me why, you know, the current government is saying that we can get away with not not pursuing that target anymore. It's still a very, very important target to reach if we want to continue to be a richer country. One of the other suggestions is that we change a little bit of the way that we're doing research funding so that not so much of it is in the purely contestable side, and some of it is in a little bit more baseline funding for our research institutes, and also to take care of things like our collections of things like genetic information, information on diseases, information on plants and animals, and other stuff that you mentioned earlier, like the geohazards monitoring. It doesn't really make sense for some of these things to be competing for funding. They're not necessarily going to find a new and flashy part of science, but they are keeping us safe. So that should be considered as well. One of the other really important parts of this is to keep in mind on what a research career looks like. One of the issues is that we have rather precarious employment sometimes in the research sector in New Zealand, sort of going from temporary position to temporary position for quite a long time before you can get something like a decent amount of job security. And that does result in us losing some people overseas already. So we could do a better job to provide people with the kind of certainty that they need to build a life for themselves here.
That was Save Science Coalition spokesperson Ben Wiley Van Erd talking to Monday Wire producer Thomas about the impacts of cost-cutting to publicly funded science and potential solutions going forward.
I'm Paddy Garin. This is the fucking news on The Wire.
This one goes out to younger brothers everywhere. This is God Help Me, Aunt Daisy by Pie Warmer.
Next door's having a radio party, leaping around the hall, throwing things. Someone's on the dial changing the stations. They put some speakers in the plum tree out the back. One of the speakers pointing at my bedroom.
Bedroom.
Next door, they've got the radio on full bore. They've got the stations at Playmore. I call the noise control another fucking night of solid gold me. They put the speakers in the plum tree. They've got the radio inside me. I fall my head into the pillow trying to block it and console me. Hold me. Got a topic party, wants it be? They've got love songs till midnight, Vegemite. I wrap myself up in the duvet, but the bass just penetrates me. The fucking radio inflates me and flames me. Fucking radio, it nags me, it baits me. The fucking radio, God help me, I'm Daisy. Hold me, I get the balls to go around. For it to shake it to the sound. I hit the door 100 times, I never come and say hello.
Listening to a sine wave.
Triangle.
wave.
Now someone else has got a sine wave.
Chiming alive.
They're building music, everyone has got a sound, they're running round.
Bestiality is not illegal. A ban on bestiality was lifted in 1944, along with a ban on homosexuality.
That was City Scenes by The Features, and before that was God Help Me Aunt Daisy by Pie Warmer. And yes, as a texter said, that is Ed Cake.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hotaka katoa mo tenei wiki. Nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kororo mai ki a mātou mo tenei rā. That's a wrap for The Wire on Rapa Wednesday. Thank you to all of our guests, the Green Party's Ricardo, Menendez March, Research Fellow Michael Swanson from the University of Otago, Alicia Hall, from Parents for Climate Aotearoa, and Save Science Coalition spokesperson Ben Wiley Van Erd. Neira huki tia mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You are listening to 95 BFM. Next up is The 1 to 4 with Bridge.
That was a 95 BFM podcast. Support 95 BFM with a B-card. Go to 95bfm.com/signup.